Welcome back to the Wealthsteading Podcast. This is episode 17, recorded August 21st, 2014. I'm your host, John Pugliano, the founder and money manager at investablewealth.com. Today, we're continuing our discussion about savings versus investing. The wealthsteading lifestyle was all about building, preserving, and growing your wealth. You can't do that unless you follow three simple steps, and that's increase your earnings, increase your savings, and learn how to develop investment income. Today, we're focusing on the savings part of that equation. One thing I want to emphasize that I don't think I stressed enough in the last podcast is in reference to building up that nest egg when you're first starting out, when you have a small amount of money. I gave the example of saving $11,000 a year and what that would produce over a 25 or 30 year period. I want to emphasize to you that if you waited for the first 5 years, if you're saving that $11,000 as a household every year, and for the first 5 years you don't invest it, you simply just put it under your mattress or you put it in a bank account that's paying no interest. The point I want to make is, at the end of that 5 years, you'll have $55,000. If you started investing at that point and got the moderate return that we talked about, the 6%, at the end of your 25 or 30 years, you would of course had more had you invested it from day one and got a 6% return. But the important thing to remember is, even if you postpone for the first 5 years and you don't invest it, since you're starting from such a small sum of money, it doesn't affect your total net worth that much. If you started investing from day one versus waiting for 5 years until you had $55,000, until you studied and learned and were confident in your investing abilities, and then started to invest, at that end of 25 or 30 year period, you would only have 5% less by waiting those 5 years. Now, you can gain a lot of experience, a lot of knowledge, and perhaps save yourself from a lot of heartache if you study and learn those first 5 years instead of just committing your money to investing in things you don't know about. It would be well worth that 5% penalty you're going to pay. The other thing I want to point out is, and this is back in reference to Mark Twain's quote about you should be more concerned about the return of your principal than the return on your principal. So what if after 25 or 30 years, the difference in your net worth is only 5% difference? That's static. That's noise. That's insignificant over the long run. The market fluctuates 2.5%, 3%, 4%, 5% in any given month anyways. If you can go a 25 or 30 year period and only have a 5% difference in your portfolio, that's nothing to be concerned about. What you want to do is focus on learning how to invest and learning how to preserve your wealth. Now let's get into our main discussion point for today. In today's episode, I'm not going to draw the line between exactly when savings ends and investing starts. We can get into that in another day. And again, you can work that out in your own life and see what's applicable to you. Do you consider yourself investing when you've accumulated $25,000, $50,000, $100,000? I can't tell you what's right for you in this podcast. I can just give you general information. But what we can talk about today is, what do you do with that money when you're building up your nest egg? What do you do with it when it's just $1,000 or $5,000? Well, as I mentioned, the financial industry, they've got all kinds of places they're going to tell you to invest. They're going to tell you to buy bonds. They're going to tell you to buy stocks. They're going to tell you to invest in your employer's 401k program. So let's break that down a little bit. Let's talk about those specific places where you would keep and accumulate your nest egg. Often people will come to me and they'll tell me they're invested in, and I'll say, well, what are you invested in? And they'll say, I have an IRA. Well, an IRA isn't an investment. An IRA is a vehicle. It's a housing place. It's somewhere where you keep your wealth. It doesn't mean anything. Having your money in an IRA just means that you're involved in a tax advantaged account. It doesn't say that it's a safe investment. It doesn't say that it's an investment that's getting a certain return of principal. It's simply like saying that you live in a house. Well, what kind of a house do you live in? It's simply like me asking you, how much do you pay for your mortgage, and you tell me you live in a house. Or ask you, you know, how much rent do you pay, and you just tell me you live in an apartment. It doesn't tell me anything about what your expenses are. It just tells me that you live someplace. So in regards to your nest egg, particularly when you're first starting out, where do you house it? Where do you put it? Where do you keep it to accumulate it where it's safe? Well, obviously you can put your money into a bank account. It can go into a savings account, a checking account. If you do invest in a tax-advantaged account, that could be something like an IRA, an individual retirement account. That could also be a Roth IRA. It could be a 401k plan, which would be something your employer would offer. If you worked for a nonprofit or an educational establishment, instead of a 401k, you may have something like a 403b. These are all tax-advantaged accounts. And that may mean varying things depending upon the program, but for our purposes, let's just say that what that means is that you're not going to have to pay taxes on the capital gains, on the interest, or on the dividends. So if you're saving your money in a bank account or in a cash brokerage account, or if it's in a checking account, any dividends that you would receive, any interest that you would be paid, any capital gains that you would receive in a brokerage account by buying a stock for $10 and selling it for $15, you know, you would have a $5 capital gain there. any of those capital gains or dividends or interest you are taxed on. So if you're saving your nest egg up for long term, if you're saving your nest egg for something that you want to use in say 20 years or you want to use in retirement, I would encourage you to put as much of that as you possibly can into a tax-advantaged account, because your money will be able to grow faster because you won't have to pay taxes on it. Now, having said that, I told you that you should be saving at least 20% of your income. If for whatever reason you can't save 20% of your income into one of these tax-advantaged accounts, then by all means, put it in your bank account. Put it in a cash brokerage account. It's better to save the money and accumulate interest and dividends and capital gains and have to pay a tax on it than it is not to have the money at all. Okay, do you understand that so many people go through life worried about paying taxes? You can't worry about that. At the end of the day, if you're making a profit, you're still making a profit. Even if you have to give the government their extortion money, even if you have to let them take a cut of your income, it's better to have more income. So don't be afraid to invest and have to pay taxes on it. Now let's focus on these tax-advantaged accounts. I mentioned there's like the 401k or 403b, depending upon whether you work for a profit or non-profit business. That's done through your employer. Oh, and by the way, there are other things that we're not going to get into. There's simple IRAs. There are a number of different funds that a small business person can put into. For the purposes of our podcast today, we're not going to explain those. We're just going to keep it simple. We're going to talk about like either IRAs or 401ks, because those are the options that most people have. So in terms of that 401k or that employer-sponsored benefit package, what I recommend is that you only contribute as much as your employer matches. And that's because there's so many restrictions and so high fees on those investments in the 401k plan. So if your employer offers a matching program, then you put in as much as he matches. If you contribute 5% of your income and he matches you, you know, dollar for dollar up to that 5%, then that's what you want to put in. If he matches you up to 20%, then you want to put in 20%. If he only matches you 1%, put in 1%. If he doesn't match you anything, then don't put in anything. That's just my personal advice, and here's why. First of all, since he's matching it for you, you get 100% return on your money. If you put in $1 and he matches it, you get another dollar. At the end of that day, you have $2. That's twice as much as you had to begin with. So that's why you always want to put in as much as he's matching. The reason that you only want to contribute up to that matching amount is that there's so many restrictions on 401ks. They generally restrict you to only investing in mutual funds. There are a lot of fees associated with those mutual funds. They generally restrict you when you can put the money in, when you can take the money out, how often you can make a trade or a transfer. I don't like those restrictions. I would prefer to do it on my own. And that's generally what I've done throughout my life. The one caveat that I would make to doing this and to only contributing up to about the amount that your employer matches is if you know that you're going to leave your job. Because the great thing about having a 401k plan is, even though it has a lot of restrictions, once you leave your employer, you can take that money and you can roll it over to your own IRA or your own Roth. You can do that in a discount broker, and then you have the ability to manage that money any way you like to. That's what I did in my life. Anytime I thought that I'd be with an employer for a long period of time, I would only contribute up to the amount that they were matching, and then I'd take my additional savings and I'd put it into like a Roth IRA or just a standard IRA. So for example, let's say I'm saving 20% of my income and my employer is matching me dollar per dollar on 5% of my income. I would put 5% into my employer's 401k program, and then I would take the remaining 15% of my income, and I would put that either into a Roth IRA or an IRA, or if I was over the $11,000 restriction that they have for married couples, I would take that additional amount and I'd put that into a cash brokerage account. So at the end of the day, I'm saving 20% of my income, I'm putting 5% of it into my 401k plan, and then I'm taking that other 15% and I'm putting it into vehicles that I can more easily manage myself. And preferably as much of that goes into a tax advantage plan like a Roth IRA or like a traditional IRA. Oh, and by the way, since my employer is matching me 5% dollar for dollar, I'm not only saving 20% of my income, I'm really saving 25% because my employer is kicking in that additional 5%. That's the way I'd manage things if I had a 401k plan that my employer matched. Now, in regards to the Roth IRA or the traditional IRA, and this is the money that you're putting in outside of your employer's 401k plan, or if you don't have a 401k or a 403b to begin with, I prefer contributing as much as I can to a Roth because they're not tax deferred, they're tax free. With the traditional IRA, taxes are deferred. They're tax advantaged while they're in that IRA, so that any capital gains or dividends or interest you receive while it's in that IRA, it's deferred from taxes. Your money can grow tax free. However, once you retire and you start drawing down that money, you start taking that money out, you will pay at whatever your normal tax rate is at that age. I assume the taxes are only going to be going up, not going down. Also, depending upon where you're at in your life, you may have more dependents now than you're going to have when you're older. For example, if you're 30, 35 years old, 40 years old, and you and your wife, maybe you have two or three children, you're most likely going to be at a much lower tax base now because you have so many dependents to write off. When you're 65 or 70 years old and you're drawing down on that money, it's only likely going to be you and your spouse, so you have less dependents to write off. So I'd encourage you, don't worry about the tax savings today. Go ahead and put it in the Roth IRA. Pay taxes on the money and let it grow and accumulate tax-free forever. You don't have to pay taxes on it while it's in there, and then also when you take it out and you draw it down, it also comes to you tax-free. Another reason I prefer a Roth IRA over a traditional IRA is that you don't ever have to draw it down. The way the current rules are written, on a traditional IRA, when you're 72 and a half, you're required to start drawing that money down. You have to take a certain percentage every year, or they tax you 50% on what you don't take out. If you have that money in a Roth IRA, you're never required to take it out, which means you can let that money continue to grow until you actually need it. If you're 70 or 80 or 90 years old and you don't need it, you can leave it in there. It can continue to grow tax-free. You're then able to pass that on to your heirs, and then they have to start withdrawing it. So it's a much better deal. Again, it gives you more freedom. No one's telling you when you have to take it out, when you have to draw it down. That's another reason I prefer the Roth IRA over the traditional IRA. And so over the years of my own personal life, I've tried to funnel every dollar I could into a Roth IRA. There are other savings vehicles out there, like for educational, there's the Coverdale, the 529 plans. I've avoided savings plans like the 529, which lets you defer money for tax purposes for your children or even for your grandchildren for saving for their college education. And the reason for that is, even though there might be some incentives there, and in particular if you live in certain states, they'll let you deduct that amount from your state income tax, those programs are incredibly restrictive. I don't know about all 529 plans, but the ones I know that I've participated in or the ones that I've looked at, the fees are high, and more importantly, these plans limit you from making investment decisions to only once a year. So if in the beginning of the year or midway through the year or whatever, you decide that you want to go into the S&P 500, they offer a mutual fund that you can invest your money into, but you have to keep it there for an entire year. Now, the thought on that is that it's designed to stop you from making irrational decisions. But the fact of the matter is that circumstances change, and you don't want to be locked into something where you can't get your money out. Imagine it's 2007 and your son or your daughter is a senior in high school, and the next year they're going to be going to college, and you've saved up $100,000 for them in a 529 plan. January 1st of 2008, you move that into the S&P 500 because you think, hey, the S&P, it's diversified, it looks like a good place to have my money. Well, that year the market drops like 40-50%. You lost $50,000, and they don't let you take it back out. If you were in any other savings vehicle besides a 529, you would have been able to say, hey, the market doesn't look so good. I made a bad decision. I want to move it out of the S&P 500, and I want to put it into a money market fund. I want to ride this storm out. You would have saved yourself a 45 or 50% drop in your college savings. But if you're locked into a 529 plan, they don't let you make those choices. You can only make them once a year. It's very inefficient, very ineffective. You're an adult. It's your money. You should be able to make what choices you want with it. You don't need a bureaucrat telling you when you can and can't invest. Again, that's why I don't like the employer-sponsored 401k plans. They're nowhere near as restrictive as the educational 529s, but they're still restrictive. The inability to move your money in and out of funds becomes even more critical the older you are and the larger that nest egg is. Imagine you're in your 401k plan and you're in your late 50s and you've accumulated $500,000 or $1 million. At all costs, you want to avoid a big correction in the market. You want to avoid a 10, 15, 20, 25% drop in the market. So for them to treat you like a child and not let you move in and out of an index fund like the S&P 500 is ridiculous. If you're in a 401k plan like that, really the only choice you have is to watch it diligently, know what your restrictions are. Maybe they only let you trade once every 6 weeks. Maybe they take your trade and it takes 3 days for it to go through. Whatever those restrictions are, you need to be aware of that, and you need to use that as a handicap. Know that those are the restrictions you're living with and trade accordingly. But when you have a large nest egg like that, you don't want to leave it totally exposed to the market if you think there's going to be a recession or perhaps we're at a market top and you think that it's too risky. My personal opinion is, and what I've done throughout my life, what I do now, I just move that money into whatever my cash option is. It may be called a money market fund. It may be called a short-term bond fund. Find out whatever it is that's in your 401k plan that's closest to a cash option. So they're not going to let you have it in, quote, cash, but it may be this money market fund, or it may be a short-term government bond fund, which is like a 3-month treasury bill. If that's the only option you have, that's fine. That's better than being in the S&P 500 during a downturn. It's not the best option, but it's all you have. So I would take advantage of it. This is one of those things where we can only control what's in our sphere of influence. If all they're offering you is 3-month T-bills as a cash equivalent, then you can complain all you want, but that's not going to change. The best thing to do is just know that that's what the option is. Sell out of the S&P 500 when you're concerned that we're at a market top or when you're concerned that we might be entering a recession, and put it into that T-bill fund. As long as it's something short-term, high-quality corporate bonds, short-term, high-quality treasury bills, then your money's going to be about as safe as it can be. You don't want to be exposed to long-term bonds in this market or even mid-term bonds. I'll explain more about that later in this episode and then in future episodes to come. But trust me on this. We're on historically low interest rates. They can only either stay where they're at or go up. And if they move up, that means that you would lose principal in a mid-term bond fund or a long-term bond fund. So you don't want to be in that type of instrument right now. Also, if you're a high-income earner, you've saved a lot of money, you're in your 50s or late 50s, check with your 401k administrator. Not all of them, but many of them, will allow you to take some or all of your account and transfer it out and put it into an IRA or a Roth IRA. Again, not everybody allows you to do this, but many of them do, particularly if you're in your late 50s. And I'm not a tax attorney, so I don't know the tax laws, but it is my understanding that once you're 59 and a half, they can't force you to have your money in a 401k plan. You're allowed to take it out and roll it over into an IRA where you could put it with a discount broker and have more options to manage it yourself. Again, I don't offer tax advice. I'm not a tax attorney. Check with your 401k administrator. Check with your human resources people where you work and see what they say about it. One other thing I want to reiterate, I mentioned it earlier and I don't know if I made a strong enough point, but remember, every time you change jobs, you can take your 401k and roll it over into an IRA. I highly recommend that. I encourage people to switch jobs every 2 or 3 years anyways. It's the best way to keep up on increasing your income. Now, you have to check and see how long it takes to be vested in your particular company's retirement plan or their matching 401k. But once you're invested in it, I would encourage you to quit that job, take that money, roll it over into an IRA, keep it at a discount broker, and get a new job where you're making more money. Do that same thing every 2 or 3 years, maybe every 5 years. There's no sense staying at one company for 20, 30 years anymore. So we've talked about where to house our money, where to put our money while we're accumulating, while we're a beginning saver. We've covered tax advantage funds like 401k plans, Roth IRAs, and traditional IRAs. We also briefly talked about savings, checking accounts, cash brokerage accounts, things like that that are not tax advantaged. Those are fine places to save and put your money as you begin to save it, but it's best to keep savings in tax advantage accounts if you can, because your money will grow faster there. Now let's move on to our next subject. What about the actual asset classes that we invest in? What do we put it in? Do we put it into cash? Do we put it into certificates of deposit? Do we buy government savings bonds, mutual fund stocks? That's what I want to narrow down on now. And this is really where the difference between being a saver and being an investor plays out. Because whether you're a saver or you're an investor, you can have your money in a Roth. You can have your money in an IRA. You can have your money in a 401k. It doesn't matter how big your nest egg is, you can house it in any of those things. So whether it's the first dollar you're saving or whether it's the millionth dollar that you've saved up, you can have it in a Roth. Where the real distinction comes in between being a saver and being an investor, it's what kind of asset class are you invested in. If you're an investor and you have a significant nest egg built up, you have a lot of options where you can get diversity and diversification, and you can invest in individual stocks, exchange-traded funds. You just have a lot of options. In this episode, we're focusing on the saver, the person that's just starting to build their nest egg. They don't have a large amount of money to invest. They're just dealing with that small amount. What should they do with it? What should they do with that $1,000, that $5,000, maybe that $10,000 or $15,000? Well, in my opinion, what you're not doing with it is buying individual things like stocks. You're not buying individual things like real estate with it. That's because you don't have enough money to buy a large concentration. You don't have enough money to buy a large diversification. If you could put that into 10 or 15 or 20 stocks, you'd be diversifying your portfolio. But if you only have $5,000 or $10,000, you can't do that. The transaction fees would eat up all your money. You'd also be dealing with such a small percentage that it would be hard to keep track of it all. If you had $10,000 and you put $1,000 into 10 stocks, even if you're going through a discount broker, that's a lot to keep track of. You're paying transaction fees on buying and selling. You're having to watch the performance of 10 different stocks. It's a lot of work and it's very little return. Again, if $10,000, even if you manage to get a 10% capital gain out of it, you're only going to make $1,000, and you had to do a lot of work to make that $1,000. When you're dealing with these smaller sums of money, I think it makes a lot more sense to go into something that gives you diversification and low transaction fees. and with the financial vehicles that are available to us today, I think that's an ETF. That's an exchange-traded fund. They're becoming more popular. You may be familiar with them, but most people aren't. And so that's why I want to talk a little bit about on this episode. An exchange-traded fund, for general purposes, you can kind of consider that as a mutual fund. I think most people understand and know what a mutual fund is. Both of these exchange-traded funds and mutual funds, these are funds that are put together by a company on Wall Street. They accumulate a large number of investors' money. They pool that money together, and then they invest it into a particular index or a particular investment style. For example, if it's a managed fund and they buy high-tech stocks, they would take money from thousands of investors, and they would invest that into Google, into Apple, into things like that. It would give you diversification within these many high-tech stocks that they're investing in. So your risk is reduced, and then it's done at a much lower fee than it would be for you to individually go in and buy those stocks yourself. And for most purposes, what I would recommend over a managed fund where they're investing in like a high growth area or value investing, for most people, particularly when you're just starting out, I would say put this in an indexed fund. And by an indexed fund, I mean an ETF or a mutual fund that invests in a broad index. For example, I think just to keep things simple, the S&P 500 is really the best thing for most people. That's the Standard & Poor's index of the top 500 publicly traded stocks in America. These are all good, stable companies. They're all not going to go bankrupt tomorrow. They pay dividends. You can get into it with low transaction fees. And when we talk about generally the market going up or the market going down, we're talking about the S&P 500. So it's easy for you to keep track of it. If you're watching the news and you understand that we're in a bull market, it's a rally, you hear the market's going up, you know that your assets are increasing. If on the other hand you're hearing about it's a market crash and the market's going down, you can be pretty sure that since you're invested in the S&P 500, that's your investment too, and it's going down. So you know that everything's in one place, it's easier for you to manage that way. You have the diversification you need, and as I mentioned, not all 500 companies are going to go bankrupt. If you invest in any one company, you always have that risk. Now, that doesn't mean that the S&P 500 is without risk. It doesn't mean that the S&P 500 isn't going to vary every day or every month. It will. During any given investment cycle, you could see your assets go up or down by 10%. You know, between 2007 to 2009, if you were in the S&P 500, you could have seen your savings erode by 48%. I'm not saying that this is a safe investment. I'm not saying that this is a risk-free investment. I'm just saying that this is a place for you to park your money while you try and build it and try and save it. In today's low interest rate environment, you're going to get better returns in the S&P 500 than you will if you put it into a certificate of deposit or bond fund. But just be forewarned, it does come with risk, and it could be substantial risk. And that's why I'm not a proponent of buy and hold. That's why I'm a proponent of being aware of what's going on around you, having situational awareness as it relates to the financial industry. Knowing that if it looks like we're headed into some type of a recession or some kind of a slowdown or a pullback in the economy, that you should sell this mutual fund or this ETF that's invested in the S&P 500 and just park it into a cash for a while. Just let it sit into a cash money market fund. I feel it's appropriate for you as an individual investor or saver to have the freedom and ability to move your money out of an index fund like the S&P 500 and to be able to move it into a money market fund just for protection, to keep it in there in cash. Now, since it's sitting there as cash, you won't be earning dividends. You won't be getting capital gains on it. So you'll have the risk of inflation if you leave it there for a year or two. But on the other hand, if you're worried about stock market fluctuation, the safest place to put it would be into a money market fund. So to boil this down for that novice person, the person that's new to saving, that's new to investing, they're just starting to build and accumulate their nest egg. You know, if they have access to their 401k plan at work or to a Roth IRA or an IRA, a good place to put that to get standard market returns would potentially be an index fund like the S&P 500. And in times of financial concern, in times when you think that maybe we're going into a recession or things don't look good on the world economy, take it out of that S&P 500 index and just roll it into your money market account. Now, a couple finer points here. First of all, let's distinguish between a mutual fund and an exchange-traded fund. I mentioned that I prefer the exchange-traded fund. The reason for that is because they're newer, more efficient vehicles for us to invest in. You know, 100 years ago, the only place you could put your money was in stocks. If you wanted to buy a part of a company, you had to buy that company's common stocks. Then about 50 years ago or so, the concept of having a mutual fund was developed. And that's where you had a fund manager that bought all these stocks for you, and you could have small individual investors contribute to those funds. So it was a good way for that small individual investor to be able to buy a piece of a company when they couldn't go out and buy the stock on their own because it would be too expensive or because it would have too much of a specific stock risk for them. That was what was great about the mutual fund industry when it was created, you know, 50-some years ago. It was a great place to invest up to 20 or 30 years ago. But because of electronic trading and computers, that's brought more efficiency to the market, and now they've been able to invent a vehicle called exchange-traded funds. Exchange-traded funds work like mutual funds, but they have less of the disadvantages of mutual funds. For one thing, you can trade an exchange-traded fund like an individual stock, which means you can trade it in real time. On a mutual fund, it can only be purchased or sold once at the end of the day. So if you wanted to get in or get out of a mutual fund, you'd have to call that fund up or call up your administrator of your 401k plan and tell them to move your money in or out of this individual fund. And then at the end of that day, the transaction would occur. And as we mentioned before, if you're in like a 401k plan at work, they may restrict you. Okay, that choice will only occur once a day, but you can only make it once every 6 weeks. You can't trade every day, or you can't trade every week, or you can't trade every month. On the other hand, when you use ETFs, when you use exchange-traded funds, you can purchase those through a discount broker, and they can be traded just like an individual stock. So at any time during the normal business hours, you can buy or sell that stock, and you know exactly the price you're going to receive for it. You can get a quote for the bid and the ask of that day at that individual second that you want to trade the stock, and you'll know what you're going to receive from it. So that's one reason I like ETFs. They're much easier to trade, they're more liquid, they have much less restrictions. And because of that, because they run so much more efficiently, they also have less costs. Generally, the fund has a very low management fee, and then to buy or selling it, there's no loads, there's no fees other than what you would pay through your discount broker. So if you're paying a $10 transaction fee to purchase a stock, that's what you would pay to purchase an ETF. Very simple, very effective, very cost efficient. I think if you're going to invest in any type of fund, the exchange-traded funds are where you want to go. It's a more improved and modern version of the mutual fund. Don't be afraid to use them. But let me add a caveat to that too, though. As I'm talking about, we're talking about for the new inexperienced investor, I would encourage them to stick to exchange-traded funds that are in a major index like the S&P 500. They're exchange-traded funds that allow you to invest in every imaginable thing. You can invest in real estate with them. You can invest in gold with them. You can invest in penny stocks with them. If you don't know what you're doing, you can lose your money. Stick to something that's very moderate, like the S&P 500. You have good diversification. You're diversified across the strongest, best 500 companies in America. Another thing I want to cover for you is diversification. I've been talking about diversification. I've been telling you that you don't want to put all your money into one stock. You don't want to put all your money into just one investment, unless it's an index fund, a broad index fund like the S&P 500, where it is diversified over 500 companies. I believe for most people, in most circumstances, that's all you need. If you go to an investment advisor, they're going to tell you, but they're going to give you diversification, and they're going to put you into a small cap fund and a large cap fund and an index fund and a growth fund and an international fund and a global fund and on and on and on. They're going to make things all complicated, and they basically just do that so that they can earn their paycheck from you. They do that so that you think that they're working for you. I'm telling you that for most people, for most purposes, the S&P 500 works just fine. For one thing, America is still the biggest and the best market in the world. We're the safest place to invest. We have the most transparency. Since we're the largest and the dominant market in the world, since we are the reserve currency, generally what happens in America affects everywhere else. And while there will be ebbs and flows, while some countries will go up and we go down, while there won't be some correlation, overall, the safest and the best place you can be invested is in the S&P 500. If you could put it in no other place, that's the one place you would want to put it. You're going to weather more storms there than anywhere else. You're going to have more security there than anywhere else. I feel it would be the best diversification for most people. The other side of it is, in the companies in the S&P 500, they're global companies. Half of their profits are generated from activities outside the United States. So when you have some self-appointed investment advisor that thinks he's an expert and he's telling you how you're so well diversified being in all these different funds and investing overseas and doing this and doing that, he's blowing smoke. Think about it. If you're invested in the S&P 500, you're invested in the number one country in the world, in the 500 best companies, and you're invested in the companies that are deriving half of their income from global operations. How much better diversity are you going to get at a lower cost where your money is in one place where you can easily keep track of it? That's why I think, hands down, an exchange-traded fund with low transaction fees invested in a broad index like the S&P 500 is the way to go. You know, one last thing I want to mention, and that's about bonds. We could probably do a whole episode on bonds. Maybe we will do that in the future. But for our purposes today, I just want to reemphasize to you things that I've said in the past, and that is that bonds are not safe. You will constantly hear the people telling you that as you approach retirement age, you should have a higher percentage of your portfolio in bonds. Or if you're invested at work in a 401k program and they have you in one of these targeted mutual funds, for example, like a 2018 fund that would say, oh, you know, you're going to retire in the year 2018, so we're going to put you in a 2018 targeted fund. And so as you were younger, you were mostly invested in stocks. And then as you gradually got older, they move your portfolio out of stocks and put you 50-50 in bonds, 50% in stocks. So the way these targeted funds work, or the way, again, financial advisors will tell you how to stack your portfolio, they'll say the older you get, the more you should be in bonds. So if you're like 70 years old, maybe you should be 80% in bonds and 20% in the stock market. And if you're only 40 years old, maybe you should be 10% in bonds and 90% in the stock. Well, again, I'm not someone that believes in buy and hold, so I'm a trader. I believe that if you think the stock market's going up, then you should be in equities, you should be in stocks, you should be in something like the S&P 500, and you should be close to 100% invested in it. Or if you think we're going into times of recession, or you think that there's troubled financial times ahead, then you should pull that out. Maybe you should pull out 10% of it, maybe you should pull out 100% of it, put it into a cash money market fund. Or if you think it's appropriate, you could be in bonds. But the thing about bonds, the things you have to understand about bonds is that bonds are not safe, particularly bond funds, bond mutual funds, and bond exchange traded funds. The reason I say they're not safe is your principal amount will vary based on the current exchange rate. When exchange rates go up, principal values go down. Now, for the last 30 years or so, we've been in an era of decreasing interest rates. So that meant that bond funds have pretty much continuously been going up or staying steady for the last 30 years. That's not always the case, particularly now that we're at very low interest rates. We're pretty much at the point where they can only remain flat or they can go up. So if they remain flat, what that means is that although your principal will remain the same, the rate of return you're going to get is going to be very low. 10-year treasuries now are paying only about 2.46%. Under 2.5%. That's a very low interest rate to be paid for having your money at risk for 10 years. So that's why I don't favor bond funds right now. The other side is what I've talked about with principal. Since we are in such a low interest rate environment, if interest rates start moving up, you're going to lose principal if you're in a bond fund. If the 10-year treasury moves up to 3% or 4% or 5%, that will have a drastic impact on the principal that you have invested in that bond fund. So you could lose 20 or 30 or 40% of your money, even though you think you're in, quote, safe bonds. Bond funds are not safe if interest rates rise. You should be very much aware of that. Again, it's hard for me to talk numbers in this podcast, and it's hard for me to explain that. But I want you to know that that should be a concern for you. If you're listening to this podcast and you're an investor that has a significant amount of money in bond funds right now, and you don't understand the principle that I'm talking to you about, contact me. For free of charge, I will be very much happy to walk you through what I'm trying to tell you. I can explain it to you on the telephone. You're putting your money at risk and you may not be aware of this. I'm very concerned about older people, senior citizens, that have a lot of money tied up in bond funds because they think it's safe. Well, it's not. Depending upon interest rates in the future, it could be very unstable. And if you have a significant amount of money in that, that could be a big risk to you. Get in contact with me. I'll walk you through that. I do it free of charge. It won't cost you anything. I just want you to be aware that that's an issue and that you could lose a significant amount of money. Well, that wraps it up for today's episode. Remember, there's a difference between saving and investing. You want to start by being a saver. You want to build that nest egg. You want to keep that money someplace safe. Early on, as you're just accumulating your wealth and when you don't have a lot of money, be less concerned about the rate of return that you're getting on your money. Be more concerned about being a disciplined saver and putting that money away, not spending it, living a conservative lifestyle. And then finally, when you do start putting that money into some type of an investment vehicle, try and move it into a tax-advantaged account, preferably a Roth IRA. Stay out of things that are restricted, like 529 plans. And then when it comes to specific investment vehicles, I really like exchange-traded funds, particularly those that are indexed to the S&P 500. And then don't think that you have to buy and hold that index fund forever. If you're concerned about the country moving into a recession or the economic times slowing down, you can sell that exchange-traded fund, keep that cash reserve in a money market fund, and wait for the next opportunity to buy back into the S&P 500. That'll wrap up and conclude our two-part series on saving versus investing. Please join us for the next episode where we'll answer more listener questions and we'll cover a wide range of topics, everything from credit cards to credit unions to credit ratings. We'll also try and address some listener questions about how to spot trends and identify hot growing markets. As always, you can send your questions or comments to me at the website, wealthsteading.com. Until next time, this is John Pugliano wishing you the best of returns.